This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I would argue that the lifetime contribution to society of a kindergarten teacher is probably greater than that of a hedge fund manager. This is the question that we sometimes think about, the difference between a private outcome and a social outcome.
As a sports fan, I'm familiar with this dilemma. Do I want my team to put everything on the line to win now? Or would I prefer that my team take its time and try to methodically build a long-term successful franchise? This is very similar to the quandary that investors, stakeholders, and management at some of the world's most powerful companies find themselves facing. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to John Wilson, the head of corporate governance for Cornerstone Capital. We discuss how managers balance trying to please dividend-hungry shareholders with keeping an eye on the future, how automation will affect the global economy, and how all of this is ultimately an issue of sustainability. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend John Wilson. He's the head of corporate governance for Cornerstone Capital. John, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Alex.
So it's been about a year since we've spoken on Sea Change Radio, and I wanted to talk to you about these investor research white papers that you and your colleagues have put out. Why don't you first tell us why they're relevant to laymen and what they are first, maybe?
Okay, sure. Well, so first of all, these are investment research notes. So they're intended for the investment community, people who invest money for other people for a living. And what they essentially do is they look at trends in the world, social trends, environmental trends, economic trends, and try to explain how they may be relevant for the kinds of decisions that an investment manager might have to make on behalf of their clients.
And in a nutshell, why don't you summarize, why is inequality an important factor now in the investment world?
This is an issue that I think has a lot of different potential implications for people. Obviously, it's something that we think about a lot in the policy space, right? People are concerned about inequality for a variety of reasons, and you know, we can talk about those. In the investment space particularly, there may be a number of reasons why. Inequality affects the people's ability to be consumers and how they consume. If they don't have enough money, for example, they just may not be able to buy things. It's pretty simple that way. It affects their behavior in the labor market. We find that there are studies out there that suggest that high levels of inequality are related to lower economic growth, and economic growth is important for investors. We write about a lot of different kinds of inequalities, and so we think about what does it mean, for example, when women face problems with their economic lives. What happens when only in certain parts of the country do you see economic growth? So there's lots of different things. Age is another relevant factor for inequality. So there's a lot of different areas that are touched by this issue. And so we want people to be aware of all of them because they could have different kinds of implications.
And when we're talking about the target audience, we're talking about people who, as you mentioned, invest for a living. It seems like for quite a long time now, there has been this push and pull within the investment world and the sustainable investing space where there's a goal to try to get stakeholders looking at the larger picture instead of just the bottom line. But then we hear pushback from oil companies, for example. Let's say Exxon is trying to plan for non-fossil fuel investments, but their shareholders want that continuing dividend, that revenue stream from the easy short-term money. Is what you're doing trying to get people in the investment space to look at the much larger picture, and how effective do you think it can be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that gets to the core of what we do. And I think one of the things I'll point out is, you know, Cornerstone Capital, our role really is to try to figure out how these broader environmental, social, and governance trends can influence business. And for a long time, people have seen, you know, these issues, which broadly you could call sustainability, as being separate from business. Or, you know, some people care about it because they have, good values or a certain kind of value, so they care about climate change or they care about equality. Our job is to try to figure out why these are important for investors to think about as investors who are looking to maximize returns. And I think you've sort of put your finger on it. There's particularly this question of time horizon, meaning how far into the future are you really thinking? So, for example, if we think about the issue of inequality, traditionally the way that Wall Street looks at wages is lower is better. Right, less wages means more money for shareholders, essentially. Right, in a very crude mm-hmm. way of putting it. And in fact, there have been, I think there was someone who was telling me about a lawsuit, although I don't have a lot of details about this, where essentially they were suing the company over its collective bargaining agreement, basically saying they gave too much money to the, to the workers. And so that is the traditional way of looking at things. The way that we look at things is that people are, and employees particularly, are assets of the corporation. Their creativity, their talent, their energy, all of those things add value. And so the more engaged people are, the better off the corporation is going to be. That's the essential, that's how value is created. And so essentially taking into account, potentially taking into account pay would be one aspect of it, but also working conditions, all these sorts of various things that you think about when we think about how a corporation treats its workers. Those are investments. They're not investments that show up on the balance sheet, but they're investments that show up in intangible ways. And so, we want companies and investors to be thinking about those issues as well. And that's one of the reasons we talk about inequality. I mean, you mentioned the issue of oil, and I think you imply, climate change. It's the same sort of thing, right? You have very steady cash flows from energy extraction, but how durable are those? How sustainable? And we're seeing more and more analysis out there suggesting that, particularly, I mean, we've seen it with coal already. We are starting to see it, see analysis showing that the long-term the long-term prognosis for the oil industry is also problematic, although it'll take, much longer to play out. And so the question is, if you're an investor, do you want to squeeze every last dollar out of those energy investments, or do you want to start thinking strategically about the next step? And that has implications, even though it's long in the future, it has implications for what companies do now. And so those are the sorts of things that we want, investors to think about, because they will have impact even though they don't necessarily show up, let's say, on an income statement or a balance sheet.
So let's dive into some of the findings that you and your colleagues reached. First, you discuss automation. And in your view, automation doesn't necessarily have to mean putting the squeeze on low-income workers. You see it as a potentially good development in the global economy. Is that fair to say?
Well, for sure. I mean, look, automation has been going on now for 200 years or so. And so we've all become much wealthier during that time. So, there's that long history there. But then automation is also very disruptive.
Maybe define automation then.
Well, I will quickly try to define it this way, that automation essentially replaces human effort with machine effort. And if we think about it in that term, the steam engine was a form of automation, right? So people, instead of walking, or riding a horse, then will, I guess horsepower is the same as human power, So in other words, human or animal power versus machine power. So, right. So the steam engine was a form of automation. And actually, if you think about the effects of those kinds of industrial, the Industrial Revolution, they did reduce certain kinds of jobs. So for example, it used to be that somewhere upwards of 90% of the workforce was employed in agriculture. And today in the United States, more like 2% of the workforce is employed in agriculture. So the number of agriculture jobs has been certainly affected by automation and over a long period of time. In the 1970s, we saw car companies beginning to use robots in their manufacturing process and substituting people, machines for people. So this is a process that's been going on for a long time. It's not something that's new. And I would say that the effects have been somewhat, they are complicated. And, going back a long way, the benefits of automation certainly flow to consumers because they get cheaper products and better, and in many cases better products. Automation may also make different kinds of jobs possible. So the agricultural worker of the 19th century became the auto worker of the early 20th century. So, different kinds of jobs, and maybe, in the late 20th century and early 21st century, they became software engineers. So there are opportunities created by automation, but at the same time, some people are disrupted. And this is the key, I think, to what we are trying to think about, is that automation provides some benefits, but also some disruption to certain kinds of people. And we need to think about, from a point of view of corporate strategy and investment strategy, how it affects different groups of people, and what that means ultimately for the companies themselves.
So if you were looking at investing in a McDonald's, let's say, the greenwashing that the corporate speak that McDonald's is putting out through its advertisements is, we are giving the youth of America a chance to move on to greater things. But the reality is different. So how would an investor, or how should an investor approach a company like McDonald's in your estimation?
Sure. So what we did, we wanted to ask ourselves that question, and particularly, it wasn't so much about, what we found was, and the types of questions that you're asking, a lot of people were asking, which is to say, are these companies really providing a living wage to their workers? And you saw a lot of activism around this idea of a higher minimum wage, right? The fight for 15 is an example, right? So instead of a McDonald's worker making $8 to $10 an hour, calling for them to be making $15 an hour. And the question that we asked ourselves was, if that happens, so as you see upward wage pressure, which is kind of that's our term for it, what decisions do companies make? Do they choose then to substitute technology for labor? It turns out not to be such a simple choice as we originally framed it. Because a lot of the technologies that are being used right now are ones that drive additional sales as opposed to reducing the need for labor. And so I'm thinking of the example that I faced this morning, which is at Starbucks, there is now this mobile ordering app, right? So you can order your Starbucks from home, and by the time you get there, you pick it up. And what they're finding at Starbucks, in which I face in my morning routine, is that they're getting so many additional sales that a lot of pressure is being put on the workers to meet all of the demand for drinks. And so it's actually, they're using the same or more labor to have greater sales, and that's driven by technology. So there's different ways of that this can affect the restaurant industry. And so this drove our ultimate conclusion, which is essentially those companies that are investing in both technology and in labor are actually getting a comparative advantage out of that. They're doing better as a result.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to John Wilson. He's the head of corporate governance for Cornerstone Capital. So, John, why is this a sustainability issue in your view?
A lot of people think of the word sustainability being the environment. And we take a much broader view of that. So sustainability to me is really about two things really about resilience and inclusion. So resilience means are we conducting our economic lives in a way that will allow future generations, you know, to live well as well, or are we using up the resources that we have? And so the climate change issue is certainly, you know, important part of that, or other kinds of pollution and so forth, or use of natural resources all fall into that. The second part of sustainability is inclusiveness. And the question is, are we creating economic opportunities that are broadly shared, or are we creating, you know, more inequality? Right. And so inherently, you know, I think that the sustainability view suggests that the broader that the economic pie is shared, first of all, that's inherently better. And it's also, you know, creates a more durable sort of prosperity. And so sustainability really is about resilience as well as inclusiveness. And the inequality issue is central to that.
Your latest research paper on addressing inequality, you have a couple points I want to dive into. You write that decreasing returns on investment in education are reducing opportunities for economic mobility in the U.S. So we were talking about McDonald's and the way they're kind of touting the fact that this is a job at McDonald's is a great stepping stone for the rest of your education. I was interested in the phrase return on investment in education. I tend to think that educators and policymakers don't look at it that way through the ROI lens. Why is this important in your view?
Well, I mean, I think the question is, what are we getting as a society for the resources that we're expending in terms of for education, right? And I think there's a danger in the ROI formulation that it becomes overly economic. And I don't think anybody here at Cornerstone believes that the only purpose of education is to produce workers or entrepreneurs. So that's not the point. But the idea is really is, are we expending resources in a way that will benefit society in the long term? And so I think, you know, creating opportunities for people who are entrepreneurial, who are going to be productive workers, but also people who are creative, who are good citizens, all of those things are positive. But really, it does come down to a choice that society makes, which is, do we want to invest as a society in our future citizens and workers, or do we want to leave it up to the private market so that people sort of buy as much education as they want? And I think the argument is that, you know, one of the fundamental tenets of sustainable investing is that we are all kind of tied together in terms of our economic outcomes. If we have a strong economy, investors will do well. If we have a weak economy, investors may be able to grab a larger slice of a pie, but it'll be a smaller pie, and so there's not much advantage in that. And so that there is a reason for investors to care about how, you know, how much resource and also how well the resources are deployed to produce that next generation of people.
I understand, and I agree with that. I think the slippery slope, as you kind of intimated in your caveat there, that no one at Cornerstone Capital necessarily looks at education purely through a revenue-producing model, is the definition of ROI on education. I mean, if we're looking at graduates of X university and how much they make in year one, everyone would then be studying business. But if we're looking at over a 20, 30-year period, how much that person is able to give back to society, to be able to earn enough income to feed their family and to live with a relatively high standard of living, we could call that a successful outcome. So defining these returns on investment, I think, are critical. Don't you agree?
I would agree with that. And I am not the expert in that. That's education policy. And I think that's a decision that sort of society has to make as a whole through the democratic process. I would agree completely with you that you certainly cannot measure return on investment in education by somebody's first year salary. And as I say sometimes, and my Wall Street friends don't like it when I say this, I would argue that the lifetime contribution to society of a kindergarten teacher is probably greater than that of a hedge fund manager. This is the question that we sometimes think about, the difference between a private outcome and a social outcome. The kindergarten teacher may not be making a lot of money for him or herself, But if we look at the, you know, the contribution to society as a whole, a lot of it cannot be measured, but is no doubt quite real. Whereas someone engaged in high frequency trading or some other arcane financial, you know, chicanery, may be making quite a lot of money, but you'd be hard pressed to explain how this is making the world a better place. That the difficulty in measurement does not mean that the concept is not valid, is what I'm trying to say.
And you write later in the piece that age, geography, gender, and race further limit upward mobility for many groups of people. For instance, the likelihood of a low-income child in the Southeast U.S. achieving a high income in adulthood is notably less for rest of the country. So with that reality in mind, there's a host of factors we could list on why a low-income child from the Pacific Northwest has a better chance of earning more money over his or her lifetime than someone from the Southeast United States. But what does that mean for the investment community? Should they be investing to try to rectify this? Should they stay away from companies from the Southeast United States or vice versa?
Right. Okay. So this is gets to a question about who the investor is and what their ultimate objectives are. Okay. So a lot of times when we think about investors, we think about Wall Street, and I've talked about that a little bit. And those are the professional investors who are sort of picking stocks for portfolios. Now, another type of investor is called an asset owner. So this would be like a pension fund or like a college endowment. Or a wealthy family with a, you know, a pot of money that they're stewarding for the next generation. So these investors are more exposed to the market than they are to an individual company. In other words, the better the market does, the better they do. The worse the market does, the worse they do. And that's what they care about. That's what their concern is. And so, like, when the financial crisis of 2008 happened, you know, CalPERS, TI Craft, they all, like, lost a lot of money, even though they themselves had been managing their assets in a responsible way. They were not the ones making the bad loans and so forth, right? So they have to start to ask themselves, how do we invest in a way that promotes the strongest economy possible? There's actually a term for this. It's called a universal owner. And so universal owners really have to think about the implications of their decisions on the market as a whole. So CalPERS, TI Craft, they have to ask themselves, how do we, if we see inequality as an issue, you know, are we able to use our investments to try to, you know, to try to change things or make things better? And there are various ways that you can do that. That's where you get into all the tools of impact investing. And I know you've probably covered a lot of these in your show over the years. But you can, for example, you can engage with companies in your portfolio to see, to make sure that they're actually doing, you know, they're thinking about the impact of their decisions on their workforce. That would be one example. You can make impact investments. So you could invest in the Southeast. You could look at smaller companies, you know, for example, that employ lots of workers and find ways to invest in those companies.
But then one of the reasons you may be looking at Southeast U.S. as a difficult place for income inequality is that there's governments and policies and politicians in place who aren't necessarily creating a good environment, not fostering a healthy working class. And that's where we see some of the lowest education levels and the highest mortality rates, infant mortality rates, are in these very red states where people have decided that trickle-down economics is the elixir that can solve everything. Just tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts, and government is the problem, not the solution. As you mentioned, decreasing returns on investment in education are reducing opportunities. So as a corporate head, do you try to take the ball and run with it and change it on your own? Or do you follow the trends and go where the better educated workforce is?
That's a good question. So that's a question that is one that you know, would be answered on a case-by-case basis, obviously, right? There's no one answer to that question. You're probably not necessarily, if you're a large investor, investing only in companies that are only in the Southeast, right? So you may be investing in a car company, let's say, and this car company is global, right?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it comes down to job security, not only for lower income workers, but also for management level employees. Trying to create a system where there's more job security at the top so that people can plan for a longer-term successful societal benefit as opposed to just pleasing the short-term fan base, so to speak?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question or issue that you pose there, right? Because it does go to this issue of incentives. Right? What are people actually being paid to do? So if you're a typical CEO and they've got usually about 5 years, I think is the average tenure of a CEO. That's how long they have in the job. And so one of the key aspects of corporate governance is how do you create incentives that align management's interests with those of their shareholders? And it gets even more complicated because the shareholders may not share an interest, right? You may have, you know, an investment manager who's being paid based on, you know, this year's results, right? And if he doesn't or she doesn't perform, you know, they're going to be out, right? And so therefore they're looking, you know, for those kinds of companies that are producing results on a very short-term basis.
The things that move an investor to put their money behind company A versus company B can be quite different, and the investors themselves may view it differently. And that's kind of the crux of what you and your colleagues at Cornerstone Capital are doing. You're trying to isolate people who can look at the big picture and then invest accordingly. Is that fair to say?
That is exactly right. And I'll give you an example, and that is Pepsi. And so Indra Nooyi, who was, you know, the CEO of Pepsi, she was really interested in moving Pepsi in a direction kind of away from the junk food direction and more into healthier choices, you know, much more committed to the community and stakeholders. You know, and we can debate, like, you know, whether Pepsi could ever do that, right, and whether there's a different model that's needed. But in any case, from her position, she was doing everything she could to move the company in a more sustainable direction and really got pounded by shareholders. I mean, an analyst would stand up at meetings and say, you need to get back to the business of selling sugar water. And she attracted activist investor who tried to, you know, force changes on the company. So she sort of had to backtrack, although I think she's still committed, but maybe more in a subtle way now. And so that is, you know, that is a danger in that investors can put that kind of pressure on companies. And particularly, it's partly a short-term problem, short-termism problem. It's also partly an unwillingness to look at the intangible value of some of the strategies that are being employed. So if it's not resulting in, you know, actual financial results at the moment, then it's a little harder to accept that than it is, you know, something, you know, a very concrete investment strategy that yields results in a short-term period of time. So yeah, that is a problem, and that is something that we at Cornerstone are trying to help people think about things in a different way. And that's why we put out the kind of research notes that we do. We look at the, you know, what is the value of labor, for example, for corporate strategy? You know, how should we think about climate change if we've got a little bit longer term perspective on it? Those kinds of questions are ones that we ask in our research notes.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. I appreciate you taking the time. John Wilson, he's the head of corporate governance at Cornerstone Capital. John, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Charles Erland and Taj Mahal. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.